From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network, Dr. Martin Spaulding from Iowa State University is interviewed by Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling about an advance that could accelerate the use of microalgae in the production of biofuels.
Dr. Martin Spaulding is professor and chair of the Department of Genetics, Development, and Cell Biology at Iowa State University. His research interests include photosynthetic carbon metabolism and metabolic regulation of gene expression in plants and photosynthetic microbes. A particular focus of Dr. Spaulding's work has been on understanding the acclimation response of microalgae to changes in carbon dioxide availability. Dr. Spaulding, you and a team of scientists from Iowa State University and the University of Nebraska recently published a very important finding involving carbon dioxide and microalgae. Before discussing the details of your paper, would you first tell us which physical characteristic of carbon dioxide limits the growth of plants and microalgae, and how do these organisms solve this problem?
The characteristic really has to do with concentration, but it's a little more complicated than that would lead you to think. So we think of the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere as being high because of the greenhouse effect and global warming, but the concentration is actually quite low. It's only about 0.035% of the atmosphere. And CO2 is the only carbon source for photosynthetic plants, and this concentration is really only high enough to allow most plants to operate photosynthetic CO2 assimilation at less than half of their maximum rate. So there are some plants that use a modified pathway for photosynthetic assimilation of CO2. This pathway is called the C4 photosynthetic pathway, and this is a complex metabolic pathway involving cooperation between two developmentally different photosynthetic cell types to concentrate carbon dioxide internally, and this uses metabolic energy to concentrate these. The result is that the photosynthesis in these so-called C4 plants is nearly saturated with carbon dioxide and operates at near its maximum rate. So these plants are referred to as C4 plants, and this C4 photosynthesis is basically a type of a CO2 concentrating mechanism. That is, it concentrates carbon dioxide internally to compensate for its low concentration externally. So some of our major crop plants, like corn and sugarcane, are C4 plants, and most plants under consideration for biomass production are also C4 plants because of their high productivity. Plants like corn, sorghum, switchgrass, and miscanthus are all C4, all use C4 photosynthesis. But many of the staple crops on a global basis, like rice, wheat, potatoes, soybean, are not C4 plants, and their photosynthetic rate is limited by the low CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. But this sounds like these are non-competitive plants, but the CO2 limitation is really not a big issue in natural systems, because as limited as it sounds for, say, crop plants, in natural ecosystems, either water or nitrogen most commonly would be more limiting than carbon dioxide, so that limits biomass and growth rather than carbon dioxide limiting it. So only in certain types of natural environments, and importantly under agronomic conditions used for growth of crop plants, only under these conditions plants may benefit from the increased CO2 or a CO2 concentrating mechanism like C4 photosynthesis. This is why C4 plants don't have a strong competitive advantage in natural systems, and the non-C4 containing plants don't suffer from lack of a CO2 concentrating mechanism. Now, microalgae are photosynthetic organisms as well, and so microalgae and also their prokaryotic counterparts, the cyanobacteria, live in the water, and in the water they have an even larger problem with carbon dioxide because the carbon dioxide concentration in natural water environments is highly variable, and the diffusion of carbon dioxide is 10,000 times slower than it is in the atmosphere. So any depletion of carbon dioxide immediately around the cells is not as rapidly replaced by diffusion of carbon dioxide from farther away. So most microalgae and cyanobacteria have some type of CO2 concentrating mechanism. They make up for the limited CO2 concentration externally by using metabolic energy to concentrate carbon dioxide inside the cell. And microalgal and cyanobacterial CO2 concentrating mechanisms depend on a different mechanism than C4 photosynthesis. They use metabolic energy to actively transport inorganic carbon internally, inorganic carbon being, for practical purposes, at physiological pHs, carbon dioxide and the hydrated form of carbon dioxide, bicarbonate. So this active transport of inorganic carbon concentrates carbon dioxide internally and allows photosynthesis to operate at maximum rates, even when the CO2 concentration of the surrounding medium is quite low. And I should also point out that photosynthetic CO2 assimilation in microalgae and cyanobacteria is really important on a global scale. More than half of global photosynthesis occurs in cyanobacteria and microalgae, meaning that more than half of the carbon dioxide consumed and sequestered photosynthetically occurs in cyanobacteria and microalgae, and more than half of the oxygen released to maintain our breathable air comes from photosynthesis in cyanobacteria and microalgae. So, as I said, it's not a simple answer, but hopefully that'll explain a little better what the CO2 relationship to photosynthesis is.
Please describe your team's discovery, and why did you call your finding a real breakthrough?
Well, I think in order to put that into context, I have to give you a little history, I think. So, microalgal and cyanobacterial carbon dioxide concentrating mechanisms were first discovered in about 1980, and since that time, several labs worldwide have been working to try to understand the mechanism and the pathway by which they function. So over the last decade or so, the mechanism functioning in cyanobacteria has been pretty well delineated, and even though it's functionally similar to that of the microalgal CO2 concentrating mechanism, the functioning components themselves are actually unrelated, and this is probably because they evolve independently. So in microalgae, it's proven much more difficult to identify the functioning components. Some of the components have been identified, but the most elusive components of this CO2 concentrating mechanism have proven to be the proteins actually responsible for the active transport of inorganic carbon into the cells. In recent years, very recently, since, say, 2006, sequencing of microalgal genomes, you know, starting with that of the model system I work with, which is Chlamydomonas, has been a great benefit to helping to identify at least candidate genes that might function in the transport of inorganic carbon in these microalgae. And one of those is HLA3, which is the subject of our recent paper. So truly, the confirmation that HLA3 is involved in bicarbonate transport into Chlamydomonas is sort of like the attainment of a major goal that we've been seeking for almost 30 years. And it's not the end, but it's a major hurdle in trying to understand how the CO2 concentrating mechanism in these organisms functions.
Talk about HLA3. What kind of protein is it, and how common is this protein in plants?
Well, HLA3 is a member of a quite large superfamily of membrane proteins called the ATP binding cassette, or ABC transporters. And these are found in all kingdoms from animals, plants, and microorganisms. In fact, the HLA3 is a member of a subgroup of the ABC transporters known as the multi-drug resistance-related proteins, or MRP-type ABC transporters. And these are best known actually in mammalian cells for export of a variety of toxic molecules from cells. But in plants, the MRP subgroup of ABC transporters has a very large number of members. It can go into the 20s to 30s to 50s within a given plant. And these include many that are responsible for uptake of a wide variety of molecules. So this is a very diverse group of transporters. In Chlamydomonas, in the genome, there's identified 7 MRP-type ABC transport proteins, but only one of those seems to be related to the CO2 concentrating mechanism, and that's HLA3. So because there's so many different types of MRP-type ABC transporters in plants and in a wide variety of organisms, including microbes, and they're responsible for transport of a very wide range of molecules, it's really difficult to say whether any others are related closely enough to HLA3 to suggest they perform any kind of similar function. They're almost certainly all involved in transport, but Based on what we know about photosynthesis in plants, it seems unlikely that there's an HLA-3 bicarbonate transporter or an HLA-3-like bicarbonate transporter that functions in plants.
Would you provide the specific details of your experiment that demonstrated that the protein for transporting and concentrating carbon dioxide was indeed HLA-3?
As I mentioned earlier, inorganic carbon transporters in microalgae generally and in Chlamydomonas specifically haven't previously been identified. And this was a bit of a conundrum for a while because there's been many efforts at identification of the essential CO2 concentrating mechanism components. Presumably the transporters would be one of those. And the efforts have really been led by characterization of mutants that are defective in the CO2 concentrating mechanism. So a defect in an inorganic carbon transporter presumably should lead to a defect in the CO2 concentrating mechanism and the inability of the cells to grow in limiting CO2. So in recent years, we recognized that the failure of this approach to identify transporters might be caused by a redundancy in inorganic transporters. And in part, this wasn't a new idea because this had been demonstrated over the last decade in cyanobacteria. So a cyanobacterial cell has at least four mechanisms for uptake of inorganic carbon, and that includes two bicarbonate transporters. Disruption of one of those transporters doesn't substantially decrease the ability of cells to grow in limiting CO2 concentrations. It's not a lethal mutation to disrupt one of those transporters. But if both bicarbonate transporters are mutated or disrupted, the cells can't grow in limiting CO2. So they complement each other and work in parallel, so you have to eliminate activities of both in order to see a severe phenotype in the cells. Because of this, we reasoned that it might be necessary to have defects or disruptions in at least two inorganic carbon accumulation or transport systems in Chlamydomonas or in microalgae in order to see a significant effect on growth and photosynthesis, similar to what was seen in the cyanobacterial cells. So in order to test this, we used a technique called RNA interference, or RNAi, to knock down expression of the HLA-3 gene. The HLA-3 gene was identified as a candidate inorganic carbon transporter based on expression studies and identification after the genome was sequenced. So we used the RNAi technique to knock down expression of HLA-3 in wild-type Chlamydomonas, and then we also combined the knockdown of HLA-3 expression with two other defects in Chlamydomonas, either with a mutation in another gene called LCIB, or using a simultaneous knockdown of another putative bicarbonate transporter, LCIA, the idea being that if we could knock down two components of inorganic carbon transport simultaneously, we might see a more substantial phenotypic effect. So the LCIB protein, if defective, prevents accumulation of internal inorganic carbon concentrations. And although it's not entirely clear how LCIB functions, our recent work suggests that it probably functions as a carbon dioxide trap, which converts carbon dioxide unidirectionally to bicarbonate, recycling carbon dioxide released internally. LCIA, on the other hand, has been implicated directly as a bicarbonate transporter inside the cells as a transporter that may function on the chloroplast membrane to transport bicarbonate into the chloroplast itself, where photosynthesis actually occurs. So what we observed when we knocked down the HLA-3 gene expression in wild-type Chlamydomonas without any other defects, was that it, as expected, it didn't prevent growth in limiting CO2, but when we looked carefully at the characteristics of the knockdown lines, what we saw was it did result in a decrease in photosynthesis and in inorganic carbon uptake and in growth, but only under high pH conditions, and specifically in limiting CO2 at high pH. So the significance of the high pH effect is that carbon dioxide and water is distributed in a pH-dependent manner between dissolved CO2, which is a weak acid, and bicarbonate, which is the hydrated conjugate base of carbon dioxide. So at pH 9, where we were observed the decreases in photosynthesis, inorganic carbon uptake, and growth, the ratio of carbon dioxide to bicarbonate, or rather of bicarbonate to carbon dioxide, is almost 1,000 to 1. So the cells at this pH are almost entirely dependent on use on the use of bicarbonate when inorganic carbon concentrations are low. So the characteristics of the HLA3 knockdown line, low photosynthesis, low inorganic carbon uptake, and decreased growth, specifically at high pH, were consistent with bicarbonate transport in being catalyzed by HLA3 or requiring HLA3. But when we combine the HLA3 knockdown with either a mutation in LCIB or with the simultaneous knockdown of LCIA, what we saw was a much more dramatic effect. The cells were unable to grow in limiting CO2 concentrations, specifically at high pH. This was true even though the LCIB mutant itself, for example, could grow normally under those conditions. So growth under high CO2 concentrations under any pH or growth in limiting CO2 concentrations at acidic or neutral pH was unimpaired. There was a specific defect in growth at high pH. And consistent with that, we also measured photosynthesis and inorganic carbon uptake, and these were also highly inhibited in the cells, specifically at high pH when inorganic carbon concentrations were low. So the interpretation of these experiments is that in the presence of a defect in another component of inorganic carbon uptake and accumulation, HLA3 is required for growth, photosynthesis, and inorganic carbon uptake, but specifically at high pH, where bicarbonate is the only available form of inorganic carbon. So our conclusion, starting with the somewhat modest effect in the wild-type cells and the more significant effect in these what we can think of as double mutants, is that HLA3 is essential for at least one bicarbonate transport system in Chlamydomonas cells, and that requirement is only revealed if there's a defect in other inorganic carbon uptake systems.
Now that the HLA3 protein has been identified, what are some potential applications for using the HLA3 gene?
Well, of course, one application I've been dreaming about since the 1980s is to transfer key components of the microalgal carbon dioxide concentrating mechanism into economically important crop plants like rice that lack C4 photosynthesis. And sort of in parallel or related to this, there's a new project that's either just been initiated or will be initiated at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines to try to transfer the capability for a minimized version of C4 photosynthesis into rice. So the goal of both of these approaches, of course, is to increase the photosynthesis and yield of rice and other non-C4 staple crops. So with the identification of the key role played by HLA3 in the microalgal CO2 concentrating mechanism, I believe that this gene is a good candidate to begin to test whether the expression of components from the CO2 concentrating mechanism from microalgae can improve the photosynthetic performance of non-C4 higher plants. So bicarbonate transport itself may not have any significant impact. We don't really know. It's very difficult to predict that. Or additional components from the microalgal CO2 concentrated mechanism might be necessary to reap any benefit. So it may require other components, such as the LCIB protein that I mentioned earlier. But the real excitement, for me anyway, lies in the possibility that we finally have identified components that we can begin to test this with. Another application that we see for the HLA3 gene that was difficult to foresee in the 1980s is to use what we know about HLA3 and other components of the microalgal carbon dioxide concentrating mechanism to try to increase photosynthesis productivity in microalgae themselves, in those that are used for production of biofuels or other bioproducts. So this is something we didn't foresee many years ago, but the real boom in interest in biofuels and other bioproducts from microalgae really makes this an attractive option to begin working on immediately.
Based upon the results of this study, what additional research do you and your team have in mind?
Although we believe we've provided compelling evidence in the recent paper for HLA3 as a bicarbonate transporter, we do think that we need to confirm this biochemically and to study, more importantly, to study the mechanism of transport employed. And so one of the ways we're going to approach this is to express the gene in a heterologous system where measurements of membrane transport are much easier and the background transport is much better understood. And the initial attempts we're going to be employing for this is to work in cultured mammalian cells where the electrophysiological responses and transport are very well characterized. Another thing we'd like to do is to use these HLA-3 knockdown strains as a starting point to identify other transporters by using a mutagenic approach. So to go back to the concept that there are parallel transporter systems functioning and that they can complement each other or mask the loss of one another, that with the knockdown of HLA-3, if we use that as a starting point, using the mutational approach, we should be able to identify other components that will be unmasked by the loss of HLA-3. And of course, as I mentioned before, one of the things we intend to begin working on very soon is expression of HLA-3 in higher plants, as well as the manipulation of its expression in microalgae. Determine whether our strategy of improving photosynthesis, either in plants or in microalgae, and thus the productivity of either, will succeed.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.